Well, there was a lot of drama through the whole thing. It was a very tough film to make. It was a fairly low budget film. You know, it was a $10 million movie at a time when most movies were, the big time movies were $20, $30 million.
How much of that went to effects?
Well, $2 million went to effects. There weren't very many effects. And I think the toughest part was when I finished shooting, I came back to the United States. I had no editor. I had to reassemble the entire movie of what had been cut, start from scratch. I went down to ILM, and they'd spent $1 million out of the $2 million. We were about 5 months away from release of the movie, and they didn't have any shots done. And I was panicked because I had nothing. I had no movie. I had no effects. I had a big mess on my hands.
When did you know it was working, that it was turning into a phenomenon with the public?
It was, it wasn't really until it came out and it was in the theaters. I was still, even the day it came out and Laddie called me and said, it's a hit. You know, the first three performances sold out and it's going to be giant. I said, look, all science fiction films do well in the first week. Wait until the third week and then let's see what happens. So I was always the pessimist.
I'm sure you know how much Star Wars means to so many, many people around the world. We all appreciate you sharing your memories with us today, George.
Is Jason.
Is Gabe.
And this week we are talking about something that we have talked about a lot. It's the fact that for a while there, everything was working against the original Star Wars. And what we're talking about this week is how from May 1976 to May 1977, the original film Star Wars went from being what looked like, for everyone involved, a complete and total disaster to being a phenomenon.
Yeah, a lot happened, a lot changed, all in 12 months. Which sometimes 12 months sounds like a lot, but when you're making a movie, it's not. When you're dealing with hundreds and hundreds of people and millions of dollars, 12 months is not a lot of time.
No, especially with this movie, because on paper and just like thinking about Star Wars and stripping away all the history and all the other stuff, just thinking about that one movie, it's almost like it doesn't make any sense how it worked, because it's so bizarre. Like we were talking before we started recording that just today I was listening to A New Hope Star Wars just on headphones. Like I just put it on in Disney Plus and I was just listening to it, which is an awesome experience and I recommend everyone doing it. But the Tusken Raider part came up and I was like, man, this part is so weird because it's just like, look, like all these sand people, I can see them right there. And then you hear like the sand people voice. So like, what were people thinking? Like when they're sitting in the theater and it's just like, what, sand people?
Well, and then thinking back, you know, as we'll get into, of watching that without the sounds or the music, or growing up your entire life knowing that that scene is a thing and like seeing it for the first time and even more like, what even is this? Like, why? Or being there filming it, like, what is this? Why are we doing this? Who wants to see this?
This is maybe the silliest, weirdest thing I've ever seen in my life. And yeah, and that's all really true. But somehow it worked. And like, what were the factors that changed the course of this movie? What got it from the brink of disaster? I thought of this too when we were wandering around Skywalker Ranch trying so hard to keep it together, when we were walking through Skywalker Sound and you see all these amazing buildings and all these amazing facilities and all this beyond state-of-the-art sound equipment. And it's like none of that would be possible without that one movie and that the crazy amount of creativity and innovation that happened in that one movie, and the fact that everyone went nuts and it inspired so many people.
Right, because it's always, if just that movie existed and nothing else after that movie, Star Wars existed, it would still be a miracle and it would still be this huge kind of groundbreaking movie. But then the fact that they're still making Star Wars stuff and all this other stuff came out of it and all these directors grew up with it and now they're making their own movies and all these people who grew up with it are now doing all these other creative things because of this movie, that this movie shouldn't have happened. like it kind of stumbled into being, really, because, and we'll get into, you know, more of the details, but like other than just kind of general production issues, just the fact that the people who they found to make this movie were able to be found and come together too, because it's not just that the movie was made, it's just that the people they found to make this movie were the perfect people to mix together to make this all happen, and they kept making these things and are still making stuff, you know, like it's like there's two levels of it's amazing that this even happened.
And it's just, I never get tired of just talking about the miracle of that 1977 Star Wars. I never ever get tired. And like, man, today I'm like doing research for this episode and listening to it, I was like, oh man, those people going to those marathons on May the 4th. I wish I could just go see A New Hope. Nothing against Empire, you know, nothing against Jedi, nothing against prequels, sequels, but I would just want to go see A New Hope in the theater.
Yeah, I've kind of been thinking about that too, that it's like of all of them, that's kind of the one that I'm kind of missing seeing at the theater. I need to bring that back once a month, at least once a month, just show it in the theater.
I wish it was at this point a whole year, right? And maybe for the 50th anniversary, maybe they'll do this where it's like the special edition where it's 12 movies, including the Clone Wars movie, 12 months. For 1 year, put one out once a month. It's like when we did Saga Year years ago.
I would just put A New Hope out every month. It just plays one day a month, every month for a year.
The greatest day of every month. It's A New Hope year. You got to see who's going to see it. You can get a punch card when you get to the theater. And if you get all 12 punches, if you made it every month, you can get like a balloon or something, or like a Star Wars Frisbee at the end. That'd be the greatest day of my life.
Or maybe in December they show Empire and Jedi, but you can only see Empire and Jedi if you went to every screening of A New Hope.
If you filled out your punch card.
Yeah.
It's like when we were kids and they had book it pins, and you go to Pizza Hut and you get all the little stickers on your pin, and then you get a personal pan pizza at Pizza Hut. Like, that'd be great if you had like a New Hope pin that you wore to the theater every time, and then you get a pizza after you've seen A New Hope 12 times.
That kind of makes sense. It's like the when they had Galactic Knights at Disney, and you could get the stickers that went on your badge or whatever, and they like didn't they fill in a shape? So it's like every time you see A New Hope, you get a slice of pizza, and if you go the whole year, you get the whole pizza.
Listen, Lucasfilm, we've got gold ideas here.
So what does this all have to do with the making of A New Hope? Probably not anything. But what I was going to say, though, is it does seem to me, too, like, you know, as much as people like the movies, Star Wars has always had people just as obsessed about the making of and the behind the scenes stuff. And I feel like part of that is because the making of the original movie is exciting and dramatic and is almost its own movie in a way, because as we get into it, really doesn't seem like it should happen. It's like those kind of movies where like everything's, it's the Bad News Bears, or that movie's old. What's a newer movie that's like that? Is that movie even like that? I don't think I've ever even watched. I don't know what I'm talking about. It's just a movie where it's just like sports movies where everything's bad and then at the end they win.
I can't think of any single movie. I can't, but there have been a lot of movies like that.
Yeah, there's a lot of them like that. I couldn't tell you any of them, but I know there's a lot of them. And that's the making of Star Wars. It is its own exciting movie.
And all of this, of course, is from the incredible Making of Star Wars book from the late, great J.W. Rinzler. We were so lucky to have him on the show a few times. These books, we've said many, many times, are the gifts that keep on giving. Every single time you look through one of his Making of Star Wars books or any Star Wars book that he wrote, you're always going to find something new. Like even getting ready for this episode, both of us were like flipping through these books, like trying to find information. We're like, oh man, why have I never read this part before?
I swear I've read this part three times, and every time there's a paragraph where I'm like, wait, I don't remember any of this. This is fascinating.
If you don't have them already, try and get them. They're still floating around out there. What J.W. Rinzler gave all of us Star Wars fans as far as books on the making of these films, what kind of, how in the world all of them got made, it's priceless, and we're forever in his debt.
I was broke. I didn't get paid very much to do American Graffiti. It took me 2.5 years to do it. And so I was desperate to get another job. When I had gotten the deal to do American Graffiti, United Artists, who I made the first deal with to develop it, said, you got any other ideas? And I said, well, I've been thinking about kind of a space adventure, Saturday matinee serial kind of movie. And they said, okay, well, we'll do that too. So when I finished American Graffiti, Universal was not going to release it. I was dead broke. And so I had to get a job just to live. And so I had this deal to do this space film. And so I went to United Artists with this idea of the space film, and they turned it down. And then I went to Universal for the idea of the space film, and they turned it down. And finally, in the process of us screening the film for anybody and everybody who would look at it in order to try to get it released, American Graffiti, Alan Ladd Jr. saw it, who was the head of 20th Century Fox, and he said, I love this movie, you're very talented, and what do you want to do? And I said, well, I'm trying to get this space thing off the ground. And he said, okay, well, I'll fund the screenplay.
There's a lot to cover here, so let's jump in. The story of the year of the making of Star Wars begins, of course, yeah, like I said, May 1976. And what was going on in May 1976? They were filming Luke and Leia's swing across the Death Star chasm. And a little bit of backup before this, in the weeks and months before this happened, Lucas had just decided to kill off Ben Kenobi, which did not go over well at all with Alec Guinness. And they had come back from the extremely frustrating, disappointing shoot in Tunisia. Like, I think right before they're doing this Death Star chasm swing, there was the original version of the Cantina, which was incredibly disappointing. So the shoot of Star Wars up until this point had not been going well at all.
Yeah, in addition, this was the very beginnings of Carrie Fisher being on the film as well, with these being some of the first few scenes she filmed leading into Leia's talk with Tarkin.
Yeah, what, April 20th in Rinzler's book was her first costume fitting. And also, I think right around this time was Harrison Ford's first days on the set too, because you think of like the stuff they filmed in Tunisia, a lot of this stuff, not a lot of Han Solo.
Right, because Mark Hamill was, of the three main cast, was filming the longest, right? So he was filming most of his stuff without those two, because he would have been filming the scenes with Cammy and Fixer and Biggs and all that stuff.
So then meanwhile, while all that's going on in England, back in the United States at ILM, they are way behind schedule. They're spending $30,000 a week in operating costs, and adjusted for inflation, that's $160,000 a week. And they still really have nothing, pretty much nothing to show that they've completed on this movie that comes out in 1 year, in theaters in 1 year.
Being behind schedule and the budget wasn't the only thing. ILM production supervisor Bob Shepard had to leave to go work on Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And John Dykstra had asked him, if you're going to leave, you got to find someone else to do what you do. But he didn't know anybody else. So he kind of disappears. And then in addition to that, too, Larry Cuba, who's working on the computer animation for the Death Star plans, and then also, I believe, the stuff on the screens in the Death Star when they're like looking at the big Death Star screen, he's behind schedule. And they basically told him he has a month less time to finish that stuff because they need it for filming. So kind of all kinds of things are starting to go wrong.
To put it lightly, the mood is very grim. So yeah, like we're saying, ILM has lost their production supervisor. They don't have a lot of guidance on what exactly they're doing. One bright spot, though, is that before May, in April 1976, shortly before all this happened, they hired some guy named Dennis Muren.
That name sounds familiar.
A bit of a whiz kid who kind of came in with a lot of ideas and a lot of fresh kind of approaches on how to get things done. And I don't know, maybe Dennis Muren, maybe he's going to go somewhere.
Well, I also like in the book, they talk about how he, I believe, like kind of applied for the job 10 months earlier. And he just assumed that the movie went out of business or like didn't go anywhere because he hadn't heard anything for 10 months.
So then back in England, they're building all these giant Death Star sets. And, you know, everyone's always heard about how the mood between Lucas and a lot of the British crew was not good. They didn't know what they were working on. They didn't know what the deal was. It didn't make any sense. And Robert Watts has an interesting quote in the Rinsworth book talking about the sets and the kind of the angry British crew.
Yeah, Robert Watts says, "The biggest problem on this picture is that we have a large number of sets that we shoot on for a comparatively short period of time. So it's been a case of trying to keep up with the set construction. Though we're employing a large number of laborers, we're literally only one day ahead on the set construction. People have been working on weekends. People have been working overtime in the evenings to get things done. But it's been necessary because we couldn't have kept up without it." Then Lucas goes on to say, "We'd really be on a set for only about one day. We'd finish shooting and then we'd move on to another set and we'd have to tear down the previous one and build another one right away, because we didn't have that many sound stages." And he goes on with, "It was really like riding a freight train at about 120 miles per hour and having the guys trying to build the track in front of you as you go."
Yeah, and I like, too, that Lucas is saying, on the same subject, that he says, "I shoot fairly rapidly, and I'd pick one place and decide how I wanted to shoot it. I'd watch the scene through the camera, move the camera around, watch the scene various ways, and get rough ideas on things." What they're getting at, I feel like, is that they're building these elaborate sets, and Lucas is only maybe filming one little part of it. And this is something that's going to come up again and again with kind of the frustrations with the crew, that George Lucas was going into this film wanting to shoot it in his style, which at the time was still that kind of documentary, quick, fast, go, move style, kind of like American Graffiti, like THX, like student films. It's kind of the neat thing that, especially when you think of the original film, it never really shows off the locations that much. And that's part of what made Star Wars Star Wars, is that you're just thrown into this world and you've got to keep up. But it doesn't stop to tell you who Jawas are or sand people are, or how things work on the Millennium Falcon or anything. And no one had ever done that before. And I think probably people, the sets were amazing. And I think probably a lot of the people working on the movie were just like, we spent so much time working on this. Don't you want to show it? But that wasn't his style. That wasn't the kind of movie he was making. And that's not the kind of movie Star Wars was, is, continues to be to this day.
So Alan Ladd Jr., the head of 20th Century Fox, is hearing negative stuff coming from the set. And in that, in addition to the budget kind of going out of control, Ladd and executives from Fox need to kind of see some footage to see, they want to see what's going on. And because Lucas is too busy, like, trying to make the movie, they just watch some footage without him there to explain it, which obviously doesn't make it any better.
And in the book, Alan Ladd says the picture started, and all I could say was, that's interesting, it looks good, and so forth. But I never said this to George, but my real reaction was utter and complete panic.
But ultimately, I think that gets smoothed over a little bit, because he eventually talks to Lucas. Lucas explains that he's not happy with any of that. It's not what he's going for. It's not what he wants. It's not all the footage. What is Alan Ladd talks about how, like, he was very happy that Lucas didn't say, it looks great, doesn't it? Like, he was very relieved to know that, at least in this instance, him and Lucas were on the same page as far as where the movie was headed.
This footage that is described in the book too sounds amazing, because Gil Taylor is the director of photography, is shooting, they find out everything on the Death Star, the book says, with a gauze over the lens.
Okay, so this is what they're talking about. The whole movie was being filmed with the gauze over the lens, because that was like, I think that gives it the, like, the shimmery quality. But the executives were concerned because there was another movie that had come out.
Lucky Lady.
Yeah, that kind of had that gauze over the lens look, and it did really bad. And the executives just assumed it was the gauze on the lens that made people not want it. So they told Gil Taylor to not shoot with the gauze without talking to Lucas. So when Lucas was watching footage, at a certain point, he was like, wait, where did the gauze over the lens go? And I guess, according to the book, Taylor was like, oh, the Death Star was too black, and like just kind of coming up with excuses. But really, it was that the studio told him to stop doing it, but they didn't talk to Lucas about it.
So Lucas finds out that all this happens. Like we said, he freaks out. R2-D2 is still not working. According to the book, R2-D2 hasn't been working hardly ever in the whole production of the movie so far. And Star Wars is 5 days behind schedule and over budget. And George Lucas has no clue what's happening over at ILM. The book talks about, though, that around this time that Alan Ladd Jr. is trying to figure out what's going on in the movie, they filmed the big throne room scene at the end of the movie. And one positive is that now that Carrie Fisher and Harrison Ford have joined the set, that the three main leads are getting along really, really well. And Rinsler talks about how their smiles to each other at the end are genuine. And he says that those smiles are forever caught on film. And I love that.
Yeah, because it is one of those scenes where it's like, the scene shouldn't be as good as it is, for the right? Like, it didn't need to be that heartwarming of just like people looking at each other. But it's like one of the best parts of the whole movie is just them smiling.
Yeah, and it leaves you loving those characters. That's like the magic of those characters, that at the end of that movie, they're all just smiling at each other.
There's John Williams music playing, and they're smiling, and you're like, I'm ready to go watch this movie again.
I also love that the story that when they're filming this scene, Mark Hamill is so invested in everything Star Wars at this point that to the crowd of extras playing the rebel troops, Mark Hamill's explaining to all of them why they're there. They haven't even filmed the assault on the Death Star yet, but he's telling them like what happened. And I just love that Mark Hamill is kind of telling everyone the story of Star Wars at that moment. And what were those extras thinking? Like, what? The Death Star?
Yeah. What is he talking about?
So now we're in June 1976.
And this, I think, is really interesting to me because it's so kind of opposite of what you think of with Star Wars and VFX. Is they were planning to do front projection, which was kind of the old school way of doing it where you're like projecting footage onto the set. So like when they're in a cockpit, kind of what the volume does now, but the old school way. And they were planning on like when they're in the Millennium Falcon outside the window, there's going to be footage that ILM made projected. And the actors are going to act to that footage and it's all going to kind of get composited in camera, but it's not working. ILM's not getting the stuff done fast enough. And like, they're starting to film the approach to the Death Star and the clips from ILM are all so short that they can't film with them. And it's just slowing things down and adding to the frustration with ILM and John Dykstra. And ultimately, they're going to decide to just go with blue screen, which in hindsight, like, just seems like, well, why wouldn't you do blue screen? That's how you do effects. That's, you know, that's how movies work. But that wasn't necessarily how movies worked yet. It wasn't an intentional thing to, we're going to film this all blue screen and ILM's going to figure it out later. Like, they just did it because they had to, because they ran out of time.
Well, and the terrifying thing that I can imagine would be like, if, you know, like you said, like the volume, if we shoot the stuff in the cockpit of the Millennium Falcon with projection outside of like, oh, there's the Death Star and there's the starscape, those shots are basically done. And they can concentrate more on the models, the X-Wings, the TIE fighters, the assault on the Death Star. If you're going to shoot it blue screen, then all that stuff has to be added later. And that's putting more pressure on what has to happen in this nebulous thing of later. I can just imagine the stuff that they're not, what they're getting from ILM is like little bursts of footage, and Lucas kind of being like, what's going on over there? Why aren't I'm spending all this money, the equivalent of $160,000 a week. Why can't I have this footage? Like Alan Ladd said, complete and utter panic starting to set in. And the movie has to be in theaters in less than a year. So then filming moves on to what, Shepperton Studios for the Rebel Hangar. The movie is now 14 days behind schedule.
Yeah, because at this point, it sounds like Lucas and Kurtz are just getting frustrated with ILM. And Kurtz goes on to say about their biggest frustration was because we were shooting and getting closer and closer to the end, but we knew that nothing was being accomplished in Los Angeles.
Yeah, and then what Dykstra, they have a quote from Dykstra kind of explaining his point of view.
Yeah, he says that George is in England, you know, and I don't care how articulate he is at describing what he wants or how articulate I am at understanding what he wants. The truth of the matter is, without him being here to see the film, it's really tough to get that cohesive spirit of working together. Yeah, and what Dykstra said, he has a good point with that. And it reminds me of a quote actually from earlier in the book back with John Barry, where he says that you can dictate the letter, but it's going to come out in somebody else's handwriting.
Mm.
Which is really the problem with the movie there, that telling somebody what you want is a lot different than being in the same room with them and actually talking about what you're seeing, like seeing the same thing and talking about it, as opposed to like telling someone over the phone, this is what I want, right? And the movie really doesn't start to come together till everybody's in California together.
Which, like we said, at this time, there's no answer to the question, what is Star Wars? Star Wars is this weird thing that exists in George Lucas's head, some Ralph McQuarrie paintings and drawings. The visual language of Star Wars doesn't exist. It's you know, nowadays, Dave Filoni can walk into a room of some of the most amazing artists in the world and be like, I need to see some droids, some ships. I'm thinking kind of this thing. And you have people that have grown up and know the language of Star Wars. That didn't exist back then. What was Star Wars? What do you want from this movie?
Yeah, nobody knew.
So ILM had completed two shots at this point. The escape pod leaving and tumbling towards Tatooine, which they were talking about the shot of the escape pod tumbling towards Tatooine was kind of thanks to Dennis Muren, who just got hired like a month, 2 months earlier. And the movie comes out in less than a year. Now, one bit of hope that is going on around this period of time is there's somebody running around ILM doing odd jobs. And when he's not doing that, he's out there like a maniac, just collecting random sounds wherever he can find them. It's Ben Burtt. Ben Burtt is out there single-handedly being Ben Burtt.
Yeah, he says he spent 70% of his time just recording stuff. And then when he wasn't doing that, yeah, he's doing odd jobs, whatever they needed him to do at ILM.
Just showing up, hey guys, how can I help? What can I do around here?
Yeah, and one of the great things he talks about is that at one point, he was just sending tapes to London of what he'd been working on for them to listen to. And he never got any feedback from anyone. He doesn't know if anyone actually even listened to them. But man, I want to hear those tapes, because it's like he would just send a tape of like, this is what spaceships sound like, or this is bear sounds that could be a Wookiee, or here's a tape of laser blasts.
And think of this. He was sending tapes of sounds that he imagined for things that didn't exist yet, because all they've got done is the escape pod.
Yeah, this is just stuff that is either was in the script or things he would have talked to Lucas about, and he's just imagining what they could sound like.
Incredible. So then what, right in late June, John Dykstra, Richard Edlund, and Robbie Blalick head to England to supervise the switch to blue screen for the cockpit scenes. Lucas is sick during this period of time when they show up. And it's interesting because the book talks about when Dykstra is on the set, the amount of work that has to be done really sinks in for him. He sees the full-scale X-Wings, the Falcon. He's talking about how he sees people running around in stormtrooper suits. He's talking about how he really starts to wonder if all of this really is possible. And the blue screen set costs another $100,000 on the already over-budget, over-schedule movie.
Yeah, and blue screen doesn't speed up production either, because whenever they have to put the blue screen up, like, they have to light it very specifically in order to work. So everything is slower and more expensive, in addition to the additional cost of having the blue screen.
It's not going well. This experience is not going well.
Well, and to just make it even less not well, the production is 15 days behind schedule. They're starting to film X-Wing cockpit shots, and the studio, Fox, insists that production be split up into several units so they can film more at once, which Lucas pushes back on, basically saying it's cheaper if you just give us a little more time because there's less people doing stuff at once. But the studio, basically, the date is more important than the cost at this point, and they have to be done filming on the date they need to be done filming, even if doing this isn't cheaper, which is got to be maddening for everybody involved.
Because this is July, and it was back in April when Alan Ladd Jr. and the executives viewed the footage, and the movie has been spiraling out of control. Probably heard about the blue screen problems. They're probably just like, this has to stop. Like, we've got to stop the bleeding. Otherwise, Lucas is probably afraid they're going to take the movie away from him and have someone else kind of come in and finish this, maybe. I mean, the book doesn't talk about this, but I'd have to imagine this was a fear of George Lucas's.
Yeah, we talked about the George Lucas from, what was it, George Lucas Man of Film, like, interview, which was after THX, before this, where he was just mad at the world and mad at the studios because they kept messing with his movies.
Yeah, it's a fact of kind of resentment, I guess, that everyone feels when one finds that somebody who has the money, or as a result of the money, has the power to make decisions that are out of their area, you know. But because they have the power and because they have the money, they can make, like, aesthetic, directorial writing decisions, mm-hmm. which they have really no business making. And it's, you know, it's in this country, the dollar is above the individual. A man's brain, a man's experience, a man's talent is below the dollar. The man with the dollar is the final say.
You seem to have arrived at a position that's perhaps opposite from the one that we started talking about this morning, was where you said that you became interested in film having no real conceptions about it, but simply wanting to make images that move together with sounds. And now your experience with the industry has perhaps turned you around, where you now have very definite conceptions, and just making images is not enough anymore.
No, I'm moving toward another kind of film. Francis was in the kind of film that was exactly the opposite. I mean, I learned a lot from Francis's type of, you know, theatrical, stage-oriented, you know, drama-oriented filmmaking.
You like that?
I'm moving toward it. I'm learning. I'm growing. I'm trying to, you know, see what it's all about. It, you know, I'm trying to play and moving around. I'm growing, I hope.
And that was before, Graffiti. And they took Graffiti away from him, too. It happened on THX. It happened with Graffiti. And he could probably see that, for reasons beyond his control, this could very easily happen again with Star Wars. And all during this time, too, when they're trying to shoot the blue screen stuff, it's 15 days behind schedule, like we said. Mark Hamill has a busted blood vessel in his eye. Gil Taylor is sick. The blue screen lights are somehow getting moved around all the time when they go to film. There's one bit of hope where Carrie Fisher was back in L.A. She comes back to the set and she brings George Lucas a gift.
Yeah. Mark Hamill goes on to explain that Carrie brought him a Buck Rogers helium pistol. And according to Mark, George wouldn't put the thing down. We saw him in the hallway up at EMI, just kind of twirling it around. Couldn't pry it out of him.
Which I Google searched what a Buck Rogers helium pistol looks like. And it looks kind of like a Naboo blaster with a lot more color on it. But I just love the idea of George Lucas like, I love this thing. I'm never putting it down. It's my favorite thing in the world. Just make me happy. Just give me life.
Yeah. Well, it's extra sweet when you think you can, you know, you go back to the Carrie Fisher interview with George at the ranch and, you know, her asking him about makeout parties and stuff. And just that relationship they had probably really started at that time where he was just so sad and she bought him the ultimate gift. Like, what does he love more than anything? Ridiculous sci-fi nonsense. And she knew that. And I'm sure that was a big deal for both of them.
She was at some store in LA and she saw it and she's like, I'm going to get this for the director of my movie. This weird bearded guy with big hair and glasses who doesn't talk and is just miserable wearing plaid shirts and sneakers.
Yeah.
So one of the last things filmed is the opening on the Blockade Runner. I thought this was really interesting where there's a story in there where Lucas is he's walking the sets with John Barry and kind of at the last minute, Lucas is talking about how he wants another hallway built.
Yeah, because I think the original idea was they were going to reuse some of the Millennium Falcon interior stuff for the opening Blockade Runner scenes.
And it got me thinking about the whole opening on the Blockade Runner and think about all the hallway shots that are in there, because there's 3PO and R2 going across. There's the opening when Vader comes in. There's the part where Leia is being interrogated by Vader in the hallway. There's Vader walking down the hallway where talks to the other dude. And that's like the first 10 minutes of Star Wars. And already it's like you're just dropped into this world and this spaceship. But it's, you don't ever really think about it. But if they were reusing hallways or something, like right away in those first 10 minutes, it would have been like, oh, this is cheesy. This is cheap. That's the same set as before. It cost more money and it pissed off 20th Century Fox, but John Barry still did it. But also this got me thinking about the Lucas of the prequels. That's how he thought back then. That's how he thought during the prequels. He thinks of new stuff as he goes. And that's why digital technology, digital filmmaking suited him as well as it did. Because he literally could be on the set and he'd make a decision like that. And it wouldn't be, you know, we got to build this whole thing. Be like, yeah, we can do that. Let's just have Ewan McGregor stand over there and we'll build the set around him later.
Yeah, ultimately, Barry seemed happy with the decision. And he goes on to say, one set we changed quite a bit was the interior of the opening spaceship. We added a great white hallway to it because it had been a revamp of the interior of the Millennium Falcon. Also, I think George wanted to set the look at first sight like you are in your conventional all-white interior 2001 type spaceship. And then the door blows down and in comes Darth Vader, black against a white hallway.
Amazing. I can't. And it's such an iconic moment. You can't imagine it being any different. You're just blown away by the Star Destroyer and the Blockade Runner flying over your head. And then Darth Vader walks in that hallway with all those guys shooting at him and stuff. I can't imagine being any different.
Yeah. Well, and think about it, at this point in production, the opening shot of the Star Destroyer flying over the screen does not exist. And this hallway did not exist until the very end here of filming in the UK. The two most iconic parts of the beginning of the movie.
So main filming wraps and Lucas heads back to the United States and he stayed in Mobile, Alabama for a little bit to visit Spielberg on his Close Encounters set. He brings photos of the movie to show Spielberg and Spielberg's like amazed and Lucas is just complaining about everything. And then what he goes to L.A. to see a screening of Carrie with director Brian De Palma. And then on August 1st, 1976, he goes to ILM. We've all seen Light and Magic. We know the story, but we're going to tell the story anyways, because this is where the post-production begins.
Yeah, and this is also like, in one way, it's the, you know, it's things are getting better. Principal photography's done. He's going to go start working on post-production at ILM. But he starts this with thinking he's having a heart attack. He has severe chest pains. He goes to the hospital and they keep him overnight. And I don't know if it was good or bad. It wasn't a heart attack. He has to go back to work.
But I can just imagine, you know, he's did his little vacay. He went to go see Spielberg on the probably happy set of Close Encounters. You know, he sees De Palma's Carrie. Just think of that. Like, Spielberg's making Close Encounters. He's got Richard Dreyfuss. He's got Terry Garr. You know, great sets. He sees De Palma's finished Carrie. Great movie. Like, wow, Brian, you really made a killer movie here. And then he goes to ILM, and they've got nothing done. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars have been spent. I would have a heart attack too. I'd probably be dead.
Yeah. He just wanted to call in sick, but he couldn't. He couldn't even get a heart attack. Even his heart attack was a failure.
So George Lucas lives, and him and Gary Kurtz create new rules at ILM to speed things up. Lucas goes back to San Anselmo and begins editing with Richard Chu and Marcia Lucas.
Yeah, because the original editor, John Gibson, who Lucas hired because he worked on Hard Day's Night, but he had edited a version of Star Wars, which was more like a normal movie, and nobody was happy with it. Which we think we did an episode on that, didn't we? The lost cut.
Yeah, that's the Lost Cut episode, which that footage is on YouTube. You can check it out. I think it was on like that CD-ROM that came out in the 90s. It's on YouTube and it's fascinating. Like, it's the slower, less intense version of Star Wars. So Lucas is kind of in his happy place where he's editing, and it's now the fall of 1976, and finally effects footage is starting to come in, and the editing team is split up where Marsha is cutting the Death Star trench run, Chew is cutting the escape from the Death Star, and a lot of this footage has to be kind of locked editing-wise so ILM can put miniature shots in, and this is where they enter in World War II dogfight footage, as we all know. And this is really interesting, though, where in late August, August 27th, 1976, a very important thing happens.
Yeah, they finally agree on the contract, and in that contract, all future versions of the film will be controlled by George Lucas, and that Lucas controls all sequel rights and licensing. And I think it's a 50-50 split for merchandising, which people at the time just assumed would be t-shirts and posters. Nothing people care about that much. No big deal.
They'll be lucky if they sell a couple shirts or something, or maybe some posters like the weekend the movie comes out or something. But the fact that at this moment, when the future of this film is so up in the air, that this contract gets finalized, that Lucas controls the sequel rights and any future versions of Star Wars, which is interesting, and merchandising.
No big deal.
As I say that, I look around the room I'm in right now. And
there's one or two things around me right now that could be considered merchandising.
So Ben Burtt, who Rinsler describes in the book as the lone wolf of production, he's still out there doing his Ben Burtt stuff, but he's thinking that at any moment he will be replaced by Walter Murch and will take over. He goes up to San Anselmo, right, for what he thinks will be a couple weeks of work to do some sound stuff.
Yeah, and he ends up staying for 7 months. But this is when, he kind of gets his first, right, like official Lucasfilm office. He sets up in the basement. He gets to see the footage for the first time. He has the editors kind of show him the reels that they have done, and he just kind of goes nuts and starts making more sounds.
What a moment, right? Like, we always talk about the Mount Rushmore of Star Wars, and with Ben Burtt's head on there, right with George Lucas and so many others, but there's hope here. There's hope.
Well, and this is another one of those like moments where in all of this craziness, like, it could have been Walter Murch and it wasn't Walter Murch. It was Ben Burtt. And how different would the universe be if there wasn't a Ben Burtt and that Ben Burtt didn't just happen to work on Star Wars?
And like we said, that he was doing things, assembling sounds and sending things off to England when he had nothing to base it off of. Just pure imagination.
Yeah. He was making his own movie of sound this whole time. Because the other thing, too, is Ben Burtt could have just been lazy and, like, just been waiting around for stuff. And he wasn't. He was, because he's compelled to go listen to things and record stuff. Like, he found the perfect person to hire him to do what it seems like he just does naturally, which is just be awesome and go around and record stuff and come up with crazy sound effects.
Because that's the thing, again, I really recommend just listening to A New Hope on headphones. Don't watch it, just listen to it. Because hearing some of the sounds out of context without visuals, it's still just as amazing as probably it was for people in 1976 listening to the madness he was coming up with. So George Mather begins working at ILM as production supervisor, and some of the fraternity feel at ILM starts to kind of loosen up a little bit, the books talks about. And one rule that's put in place when Mather arrives is that they need to make 5 shots a day. And everyone says in the book and in Light and Magic that it's superstar Rose Dignan who really saved the day there. And we got to give a shout out to our episode from, what, a couple years ago now, when we got the amazing opportunity to talk to Rose Dignan about all of this. And it's one of our favorite episodes we've ever done. And yeah, if you want to hear more about how Rose Dignan saved Star Wars, go listen to that episode. Hear it from herself.
Yeah, she was great.
So what? Now we're months away. There's more hope than there was before, but there's still a lot to do. To a lot of Lucas's friends and people in the studio, Star Wars looked like still a very expensive disaster. But how was George Lucas feeling about it all?
So lucky for us, during this time, on September 14th, 1976, Lucas sits down with Charles Lippincott for his first extended interview since before principal photography began. And in reference to the studio, Fox, Lucas says Fox still doesn't know what the film is. They're not a model of confidence. They're still worried that they've got a big and expensive something on their hands, which they can't describe or understand. He's asked about ILM, and he says, given another 5 years and another $8 million, we could get some pretty spectacular effects out of there, but we don't have the time or the money. I don't know what else to say. That's the biggest problem.
Yikes.
He talks about the visuals in the movie, and this is him maybe being a little bit happy. He says, the thing I like about this film is the fact that it was written and designed as a movie. The elements that are interesting in it are cinematic elements, not literary elements. It was designed as an emotional visual exercise, not as an intellectual exercise. I'm sure we're going to get a lot of backlash because of that, but I'm not afraid of it being called a comic book movie.
That reminds me of the Gene Siskel review where he's like, it's like a pinball game.
Actually, there's another, they ask him for some predictions about Star Wars, and I like, George says, Star Wars could be a type of Davy Crockett phenomenon.
Good reference, George.
Yeah. I don't know whether I've done it. I don't know. He goes on to talk about Gene Roddenberry and how Gene Roddenberry said Star Trek didn't really feel like a series until the 10th or 15th episode. He says, Lucas goes on to say, someday I'll do another movie like this maybe, which will be much closer to my original plan.
And you can see that movie in theaters starting May 3rd, 2024.
Yeah.
So, yeah, at ILM around this time, thanks to George Mather, Rose Dignan, shots are getting done. And for the first time, the book talks about how there are people there who are saying things like, whoa, that looks pretty cool. And this the odd experiment of a combination of young geniuses is all starting to gel. And by October 30th, kind of going all the way into the end of the fall, the effects work is amazingly at about 25% done. Things are looking up in Light and Magic. George Lucas calls this period of time a mission of faith. But then also around this time, he visited Martin Scorsese and told him that he never wants to direct again.
Well, and it's nice to think it's like, oh, they're 25% done. They're making progress, but they have like 6 months left to go.
Until it's in theaters.
But yeah, before you know it, it's November and things are moving along. R2-D2 has a voice. The trench run is now shortened to one run instead of two. The opening shot of the Star Destroyer was filmed at ILM. So the movie's starting to become the movie we all know and love.
And around this time, Charles Lippincott is out there at conventions. And he was even doing this before this in the summer at San Diego Comic-Con. But he's selling fans on this new space fantasy movie coming out that summer from the guy that made American Graffiti. And it's November. The novelization is out in stores. The deal from the Marvel comic book adaptation is done. It's coming. And the film's first trailer is coming out that holiday season with effects finished last minute so they can be in there. So the movie's still far from being done, but they're working hard to get it out there. And yeah, that trailer is playing in theaters.
Somewhere in space, this may all be happening right now. 20th Century Fox and George Lucas, the man who brought you American Graffiti, now bring you an adventure unlike anything on your planet. Star Wars.
Here they come.
The story of a boy, a girl, and a universe. Star Wars, a billion years in the making, and it's coming to your galaxy this summer.
The movie is for real at this point. People can see trailers. It has to happen. It's too late. It's too late to stop now.
So January 1977, we're in 1977. This is a key moment. Just like Ben Burtt setting up in the basement, making his sounds, just like ILM churning out at least five finish shots a day. January 1977, enter John Williams. Recommended to Lucas by Steven Spielberg, George Lucas shows him what he had reel by reel.
Yeah, and most of the movie at this point had temp tracks. A lot of it was the piece The Planets by Holst, which if you ever go listen to that piece or are familiar with it, there's some very Star Wars-y bits in that. That kind of gave Williams some direction on what Lucas was looking for. Not necessarily sci-fi, but more grand, epic space fantasy, big orchestra sound.
And then from January to February 1977, John Williams writes the score to Star Wars.
People might buy that record, maybe.
It might just change film history. It might just change the way people look at film scores for maybe the rest of time. Who knows? We'll find out. So it's the end of January, and George Lucas shows a cut of how it's going to Alan Ladd Jr., and Fox executive Gareth Wigan is there, and Alan Ladd's wife is there, and there's quite the reaction. It still doesn't have Williams' score yet, and the effects are still far from done, but it has quite the reaction.
Yeah, Lucas says, "I was sitting right next to Gareth, and he turned to me, and he had tears in his eyes. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe Gareth Wigan was crying. I thought he was crying because he was thinking, oh my God, our whole careers are destroyed. Our lives are destroyed. But he said, this is the greatest film I've ever seen. And I thought, no way. I've never had a studio executive say that at the end of a screening. I thought, this is really weird."
And Alan Ladd Jr.'s wife loved it too, right?
Yeah. Lucas says, Laddie didn't know what to think. His wife loved the movie. She was going on, but Laddie was quiet and said, "Gee, George, you did a really good job."
So superstar Gareth Wigan, right, goes back home after seeing this rough cut of Star Wars and is telling his family about this life-changing experience he had watching Star Wars.
Yeah. He says, "I sat my family around the kitchen table and I said, the most extraordinary day of my life has just taken place. I want you to remember this day because I never thought I would have a day's experience like the day I've had today in seeing this film."
I can relate, Gareth Wigan.
And I can imagine what his family looked like when he said that, because I think we've all had that conversation.
Gather around the kitchen table, everyone.
Jason, you're 25 times into Phantom Menace. Why? I've never had a day like today. It's the most extraordinary film I've ever seen.
So Fox gives George Lucas, possibly because of this screening, another $20,000 to improve the cantina, enter into the Star Wars formula, Phil Tippett, John Berg, Lane Liska, Doug Beswick. And it's February, and although things are better at ILM, tensions are very high between Lucas and Dykstra. Lucas is saying he needs stuff done and doesn't get along with the big personality that is John Dykstra. John Dykstra can't just do, he's saying to George Lucas, he can't just do it like Lucas wants. Again, this all kind of reminds me of, you know, the Lucas of the prequels and digital technology when things can just be done.
There's another great part in the book where Lucas is talking about how he couldn't be, I'm sure this is future Lucas remembering the past, but he says he couldn't really be mad at Dykstra because he asked Dykstra to do the impossible. And some people can do the impossible and some people can't, but you can't really blame someone for doing something that's technically, you can't really blame somebody for not doing something that's technically impossible.
Right. It's very true. It's very true. So around late February 1977, we're just months away from the big release. There's the famous moment where Lucas shows the unfinished film to Brian De Palma, Steven Spielberg, Matthew Robbins, Hal Barwood, Gloria and Willard Hike, Jay Cox, and some folks from ILM were there too. We all know this story, but I still love that he shows it and everyone's confused. De Palma says, "What's all this for shit?" But Spielberg loves it.
Spielberg is on the wavelength. He's ready. He's ready for this movie.
He's like, "So what you're telling me is you got the merchandising rights. So do I order a t-shirt from you, George? Because I want one right now and I need a hat." Yeah. But then what, they go to a Chinese restaurant afterwards and Lucas and De Palma argue the whole time. But out of that argument comes the opening crawl, which, think of this, it's February 1977 and Star Wars does not have an opening crawl yet.
How's it even a movie at that point? All the iconic bits are just barely there.
But word has gotten out that a bunch of people saw it, right? And Spielberg is still kind of the golden boy. I mean, the guy made Jaws. He's making Close Encounters. And what Ladd calls up Spielberg, right? Like, "Hey, give me the straight dirt."
Yeah, he calls up Spielberg to get the inside scoop. "Tell me the truth. What's going on with this movie?" And Spielberg says, "I think it's going to make a fortune."
We talked about it in our Spielberg episode. Spielberg has been the number one Star Wars fan for the longest. I think Spielberg's been a Star Wars fan before George Lucas was a Star Wars fan.
Well, I think technically Lucas has never been a New Hope fan. Maybe not till 97. So yeah, Spielberg has the longest running Star Wars fan. He's the number one fan.
So March 1st, 1977, this blows my mind. There's a new cast member in Star Wars.
Yeah, someone you may have heard of, James Earl Jones, records the voice of Darth Vader. He completes his work in 2.5 hours in 1977 in March. So before that, another iconic part of the movie didn't exist, wasn't a thing. Darth Vader didn't have a voice.
He did, but it was Dave Prowse in the mask.
Darth Farmer.
So all these times, all these people have watched the movie, it was Dave Prowse in the mask. "Tear this ship apart until you found the plans while they're alive."
"I don't know what you're talking about. I'm a member of the Imperial Senate on a diplomatic
mission." "You are part of the Rebel Alliance and a traitor. Take her away."
It's kind of insane. That may be the most insane of all this insanity, really, is that, yeah, I don't think about that when, like, he's showing the movie to people that, yeah, either Darth Vader doesn't have a voice or it's David Prowse's voice because there's no James Earl Jones yet.
So March is a big month, right? Because later that month, John Williams is conducting the London Symphony Orchestra for the score to Star Wars. Lucas goes to London to experience this. Now, like, just imagine you're George Lucas. Everything he's been through in the past year, let's say, since going all the way back to Tunisia before we started talking about what happened. And you're sitting there at the recording studio and you hear John Williams with the full London Symphony Orchestra just ripping into that main title. And And right, once he sees his film set to that John Williams score, he happily calls Steven Spielberg on the phone and holds the phone up so Steven Spielberg can hear what's happening. I think about that all the time, of just how that must have felt for George Lucas.
Yeah, because it almost kind of adds a perspective to where there's one aspect that, you know, he always wants to work with John Williams on the Star Wars films because he likes the music, but there's probably also like some subliminal gratitude to John Williams kind of turning him around to just being happy about the film he was working on. Like, other than just doing a good job with the music, like, you know, he made him happy again.
And what that score adds to that movie, you know, you imagine all these people watching it without the score. Like, the score from the first seconds of the movie tells you that this movie is special, that this movie is an event, that you've never seen or heard anything like this in your life. I don't know. What John Williams added at that moment, that is one of the key moments that turned everything around.
And it's March.
It's March.
Right. There's two. It's going to be in theaters in two more months. It's now kind of maybe as close to what we would think Star Wars, the original film, is at this point now. All the big pieces are there.
It's April, and Phil Tippett and John Berg have done the stop motion chess last minute, 1 month before the movie comes out. All the final pickup shots and finishing touches by ILM are wrapping up. The movie is finally ready to come out, to be shown to general audiences. And on May 1st, 1977, at the North Point Theater in San Francisco, Star Wars is shown for the very first time to an unexpected audience. And the Fox logo, the long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, comes up. The Star Destroyer comes onto the screen, and according to Renzer's book, the audience stands up and cheers. And for 2 hours, according to the book, they're laughing, gasping, cheering. They applaud again at the ending. Seriously, no one had ever seen anything like that before. Star Wars is the first movie I ever saw. I was like 3, I think, because I saw Star Wars before I saw Empire. I think I was 3. And I think I've said this before, I think it might have had a little bit of an effect on me.
Yeah, it might have broke your brain.
I think it did. I've never recovered, ever. I might have a little bit of a problem.
It's like you weren't walking. Even though you were 3, you weren't walking, and you saw the Star Destroyer, and you stood up and you walked. You're like, I'm just going to keep walking around.
There's a great story in the book, too, about Richard Chu, editor Richard Chu. He's elated because probably everyone was holding their breath, like, what is going to happen? And he finds George in the theater lobby.
Yeah, and he goes up to Lucas and says, George, isn't this amazing? And Lucas is like, what, I'm still trying to get this movie to work? Like, he's still not happy with it.
We got to change Brew's voice. I got to start working on that right away. It's not right. Not right. Telling you, Brew sounds weird.
Yeah, if only I can make this movie so people like it.
There's a really sweet moment in the book, too, where on Richard Chu's way to go talk to George Lucas, Lucas's father is going around the theater lobby, like, pumping his hands in the air, and he stops Richard Chu and says, thank you for helping George make this movie.
Well, he didn't want his son to have a heart attack and die because of these silly motion pictures.
Even George Lucas's father saw Star Wars and was like, that's the most amazing thing I ever saw.
But no rest for George Lucas, because it's Wednesday, it's May 25th. Star Wars is opening in the United States in 32 theaters. But Lucas is still working with Ben Burtt on the mono mix with Marcia in a flat in Hollywood. And they go on a break to get hamburgers, because if George Lucas has time for a break, he's going to get hamburgers. They go to Hamburger Hamlet across from the Chinese Theater, and everyone knows the story. There's lines going way down the street. What are these lines for? Why are there people waiting? What are they going to go see? And it's Star Wars.
He calls Alan Ladd Jr. He's like, oh, what's going on? How's it doing? And Alan Ladd Jr. is like, all the shows are sold out. And Lucas famously says, well, that happens with every science fiction movie. They do good the first weekend, and then they'll drop off. But it never dropped off. And as the summer continued, it opened up in more and more theaters across the United States, then all over the world. And Star Wars madness spread. It's never stopped. Us talking right now, Lucasfilm, Skywalker Ranch, The Bad Batch, The Acolyte, all the shows, everything that we love, the fact that this thing is going to live beyond us, all came from that one year, really, thanks to what? An insanely talented group of people. Like you said, that it's a miracle that Star Wars got made, but it's also a miracle that it got made by this very unique combination of people. From Ben Burtt to John Dykstra to Dennis Muren to John Williams to Rose Dignan, and Phil Tippett coming in with, you know, John Berg, Richard Edlund. It's these geniuses that came together to make this thing that has gone beyond just being a movie. Like Lucas saying, well, it's just a movie. It's like, could be like David Crockett, and it's just, you know, it's a fun thing. It's more than a movie now.
It's bigger than Davy Crockett.
A little bit.
Yeah. It's amazing what can happen in 12 months.
Star Wars,
17 times. Star Wars, 22
times. 24. 40 times and it was great each time.
41 mal.
About 57 times.
69 fois.
You can never get too much of Star Wars. I've seen the first Star Wars 153 times.
All together, we have seen Star Wars 324 times.
People will camp out overnight to see the Rose Parade. And, this is worth at least three times as good as the Rose Parade, so we're here for three times as long.
We've been here for 6 days, and it's great!
I think one of the key factors in the success is that it's a positive film, it has heroes and villains, and that it essentially is a fun movie to watch.
It's the new Star Wars Land of the Jawas that you put together. Action figures sold separately. You can move the action lever and make the Jawa capture R2-D2.
R2? Are you all right? What are they doing to you?
You can raise the elevator and make R2-D2 disappear into the sandcrawler.
Hang on, R2. I'm right behind you. Me too.
Kenner's new Star Wars Land of the Jawas. Action figures each sold separately.
And these blast points, too accurate for sand people. Only Imperial stormtroopers are so precise.
Guess what, everybody? Apple Podcast reviews. Imagine that. When you get done listening to this, help us out. Write something nice with 5 stars. Write, "Hey, Blast Points, thanks 3PO, thanks for this episode." Just leave 5 stars, and then more people, when they're like looking for Star Wars podcasts, will find Blast Points, and they'll listen to the Norky episode and never listen to anyone ever again.
And check out our website, blastpointspodcast.com, and make sure you're following us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. And if you're on Facebook, make sure you're part of our Super Chill group.
And the website is a great way to search for back episodes. So if you want to look for the Rose Dignan episode or the Lost Cut episode or any episode we've ever done on A New Hope, all you got to do is use the handy-dandy search feature and they'll come right up. And if you want to support the show in a different way, we got the Blast Points Army on Patreon, where we're doing Bad Batch recap episodes still. By the time you're listening to this, our episode for Juggernaut, the Turbo Tank episode, will be out.
It's a good episode, and it's some good stuff on the Patreon. It's a win-win.
But that wraps up 397. We're just a handful of episodes away until the big 400.
Yeah, what could that be?
So, until next week, everyone, thank you all so much for listening.
Bye-bye.
May the Force be with you. Goodbye, old friend. May the Force be with you.
Everything's coming to a close right now. How do you feel? Everything's nearly finished.
Tired.
The perfect comment. Right?
May the Force be with you!